You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko just no kingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā, te rā wha o hui tanguru. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for rā to the 4th of February. I'm Justin and I am alone in studio at the moment because my producer, Louis Laws, is still doing the hard yards for the show, but he'll join me shortly. But coming on the show today, I talked to a Hong Kong lawmaker about medical workers' strikes in Hong Kong. An international desk also gives an explainer on the Iowa caucus, while Louis talks to a freshwater advocate about wetlands. He also talks about vocational training. And finally, we will cross to Waitangi for a report on Waitangi Day. As always, he aha o whakaro, get in touch with us with any thoughts you have. Tukapatuhi mai, you can text us on 5395, or why mai, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Me kawa e ware ware, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ane hei pakihiri roki roki maronga i te paitukutuku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM airekati.com. And don't forget, you can catch all these stories in full and more by podcast on our website, 95bfm.com. I tēnei wā tonu, we are going to Hong Kong first.
Today, we do not know what they want. They do not know themselves what they really want.
I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it.
Brexit means Brexit.
To Wire.
So, before we start, this is a timely opportunity to remind the 95BFM listenership that any and all discussions of international public health emergencies, including the current novel coronavirus, does not provide any excuse for racially charged and or xenophobic rhetoric directed towards any ethnicity or groups of people. It won't be tolerated on air, and we will waste no time reading or engaging with such feedback. And a reminder, if you are at all concerned, you are showing any symptoms, particularly if you traveled overseas in the last month, you are encouraged to seek medical advice and contact a doctor or helpline on 0800 611 116 for free. And if you're seeking further information on the current novel coronavirus, the World Health Organization is the most up-to-date and reputable source. Please think twice before engaging with, or worse, repeating information from disreputable sources. At best, this spreads ignorance, and at worst, it helps spread prejudice, panic, and possibly even contributes to the mismanagement of the health emergency itself. But now, around 2,700 Hong Kong medical workers started a five-day strike yesterday in protest of the government's response to the coronavirus outbreak. While the current measures in place included partially closing the land border with mainland China and suspending train services, unions demanded a full-body closure to all arrivals from the mainland. Radio Television Hong Kong's Jimmy Choi reports.
Many medical workers turn up at various public hospitals across the city, not to go to work, but to make their voices heard. They chanted slogans and handed out leaflets, urging their colleagues and members of the public to support their cause. At Prince of Wales Hospital, more than 200 medical workers joined the queue to sign up for the strike. At Queen Elizabeth Hospital, medical staff wore white ribbons and put up stickers which say, "Full closure of the border." This nurse says she's sorry that the campaign is affecting patients, but she hopes the public understand that going on strike is a last resort.
First, I would like to apologize to make the patient wait for a long time for the operation. We really don't want to do that, but the governor never take any action to stop the patient to coming to Hong Kong. So it's the last resort that we take this action. I hope Hong Kongers can understand what we are doing.
Dr. Lai Ching Lung says he won't take part in the strike, but he says he supports his colleague's action.
Because I'm a doctor, I don't want to be on strike. Okay, but I support them because if that is the only way for us to get the government to close the borders, I support them.
The Hospital Authority Employees Alliance, the union organising the strike, says more than 2,400 medical staff took part in day one of the campaign. Union leader Winnie Yu says another 6,000 staff will join the action if the government refuses to accept the demand. They would include essential personnel.
Our expectation of the impact is about 10% of HA staff will participate. So we expect that the emergency service would be also have impact.
There were mixed views among patients towards the strike. 22-year-old Yo-Yo is suffering from a chronic disease. She says she has to go to the hospital to get an injection every month. But she says she supports the strike because the government is not doing enough to protect the medical workers. This woman, however, says she doesn't think health professionals should use the strike to force the government to close the border. She thinks they're politicizing the matter and putting patients' health at risk. Chief Executive Carrie Lam says the government's decisions to shut down more border crossings has nothing to do with the strike. She also has some tough words for those behind the campaign, saying anyone who thinks they could use such an extreme way to put pressure on the government will not succeed.
I spoke with Joseph Lee, who is the lawmaker for the health sector in Hong Kong's Legislative Council, and I first asked about the current conditions in hospitals right now.
Up to this moment, I can see from various media indicated that there are more than thousands of health workers are on strike. Obviously, some of the healthcare services might be affected, but we have to reiterate that calling for strikes is a kind of measures which aiming at not affecting the patient care or healthcare service, but to alarm the government that the government is not doing well or even doing nothing to stop potential visitors and bringing those pathogens across the border and infect into Hong Kong. And if the government have do this very well and have a vigilant and stringent measures to stop this, that will ease the currently overloaded public currently very overloaded public health services system in Hong Kong.
Is the same situation applied for the private sector as well?
Well, my understanding is that most of the health professionals joining this industrial strike in Hong Kong today is from the public sector. And I have no information at this moment whether how many they are from private sector.
Well, and what about the local communities? What is the situation for preparation for this outbreak?
Well, as far as the local community is concerned, people in Hong Kong are now staying vigilant for fighting against this new coronavirus, trying to stop any kind of community outbreak by participating actively in protecting themselves, especially when they are go into public or other areas, overcrowded areas. Unfortunately, the current situation is quite worrying in Hong Kong simply because the lacking supply of face surgical masks and also some of these sterilizers, hand sterilizers, and that kind of situations. And in this kind of situation, the SAR government is lacking of leadership and coordination in assuring the public that how the stocks of face masks will be adequate for public use and how would the stocks will be coming in the future, make sure that individual health measures or hygienic measures can be safeguarded. It's disappointing that for the past week, people in Hong Kong are running for various sources, sourcing for face masks and sanitizers. And but the government in Hong Kong will stay inert in providing any kind of information or even a substantial price to assure Hong Kong people that the supply of surgical masks is adequate and people will not be panicked for wanting for surgical masks in Hong Kong.
But regarding all the strikes, do you think it is responsible for these medical workers to go on strike when the city itself is frankly facing a public health crisis?
Well, that would be a kind of controversial on the issue. On one hand, I think most health professionals are well prepared and are willing to fight for this infectious disease. On the other hand, they are very worried, even though they are very hardworking and willing to fight for this infectious disease, that's the NCoV virus in Hong Kong. But if the infected cases are multiplied, are escalated because the government do not stop visitors visiting Hong Kong, that will cause a lot of problems. So with no choice, I think most of the frontline health professionals in Hong Kong call for strike, these kind of strategies to alert the government, aiming at government and giving pressure to the government to stay vigilant and try to stop any visitors bringing these pathogens, this virus, cross border and infection to Hong Kong, which might as a result and overload the currently already very high-risk public health system.
How long do you expect, as the lawmaker for the health sector, the strike is going to last?
Well, it is anticipated that the industry, because at this moment, the government is reluctant to have any discussion with the frontline health workers and the association who are calling for strikes. It would be very disappointed that the government is quite reluctant at this stage to enter into any kind of negotiation or discussion. And as one of the trade union anticipated that the strike will last for 5 days. And so I guess the most important thing at this moment is the SAR government is willing to face-to-face talk with the frontline health workers so that have a kind of reassurance and make sure that the situation is in control.
Do you think that the government of Carrie Lam will change their stance because of these strikes?
It is quite obvious that for the past 6 months, the current administration is quite reluctant to listen to the voices of Hong Kong people. As you can see, now, even though the health workers are called for strikes, and people in Hong Kong are quite understandable because they do note that the reason why the Hong Kong health professionals are calling for strike is to protect the public health and try to minimize community outbreak. But unfortunately, the SAR government is quite reluctant to discuss the situation with the frontline workers. So might make the situation quite worse as far as the community outbreak, the risk of community outbreak is concerned. If visitors from high-risk area or infected area in China continuously visiting Hong Kong right now.
You and other lawmakers in the Legislative Council have been critical of the decisions that Carrie Lam's government had made on the coronavirus, such as partially closing the border with China. Why do you think these measures are inadequate?
Well, I guess up to this moment, it would be totally disappointed that Carrie Lam's government, well, is basically focused on political consideration, well, not to tighten the control of the border checkpoint instead of based on scientific evidence. And we will make people in Hong Kong quite disappointing or even agony that the government is not doing the right thing to protect people in Hong Kong. So as a lawmaker, especially representing health services, I am quite disappointed that, Carrie Lam's government is not making a right decision, not protecting the Hong Kong's people and not trying to even protect the frontline health workers.
The main demand for this strike, and obviously from you and other pan-democrat lawmakers, is the full closure of Hong Kong's border with China. This has been described by Carrie Lam over the weekend as quote-unquote discriminatory. And for you, as the lawmaker for the health sector, what are your thoughts on this?
It would be very astonished that the claim for Carrie Lam's government trying to justify not closing the border is based on a kind of discrimination, because the WHO might worry about these things. As you can see, other countries like the USA, Italy, and other countries has already closing the border to protect their own citizens. And I don't think Carrie Lam's argument is well justified, because we are not trying to discriminate anyone. We are in the notion of protecting public health and stop potential infected person coming into Hong Kong, be it Chinese people, overseas people, or around. That is the kind of right public measures, right measures to protect public health. And what we are trying to argue for is not just closing, totally closing the boundary. What we are quoting, or what we are arguing for, is to stop visitors. They are potentially infected or from high-risk area, not allowed to visit Hong Kong. If people are from these areas returning back to Hong Kong, they are Hong Kong citizens. We have already had very stringent and rigid measures like border checkpoints, health checks, fast testing, even quarantine, that kind of measure to protect the people in Hong Kong. So why just trying to misled people that we are not able to close the border, that would lead to discrimination, that kind of situation.
And my final question for this is, how concerned should we be over this coronavirus overseas, such as in New Zealand?
Well, I guess this is the result of the Chinese government and trying not to reveal the whole picture. Previously, in the last December, so caused a lot of trouble. As you can see, the spread of this new coronavirus is not just in China, but all over the world. And that would cause a lot of problems. That's why most of the country are trying to instill stringent close-border measures to prevent this new coronavirus going into their own country. That is the measures to protect public health.
That was me talking to Hong Kong Legislative Council member Joseph Lee. Just an hour after I spoke to him, the Hong Kong government further stepped up in tightening border control measures, closing all but three border points, including the airport, saying the move will protect the city from a wider outbreak of the coronavirus. Chief Executive Lam said the decision to sever more connections with the mainland is not related to the strikes and those using quote-unquote extreme actions to try to force the government's hand will not succeed. The same evening also saw talks between the hospital authority, the body that manages Hong Kong's hospitals, and the union break down after just 20 minutes, when the HA's chief executive, Tony Koh, rejected the union's demands to issue a public statement from urging the government to impose a full border shutdown and a promise for management not to seek retribution against any staff members who joined the strike. The union has announced as a response they will escalate their industrial action today, meaning around 9,000 medical workers will be set to go on strike. Ko te wai atene marunga BFM. We will be back after a break. You're on BFM with Justin.
Auckland Transport is making improvements to Tāmaki Drive between Key Street and the Ngāpipi Bridge starting early February. We are extending the cycleway from Key Street up to the Ngāpipi Bridge and will also be raising the height of the road in some sections to protect against flooding. During the works, drivers may experience delays on Tāmaki Drive during peak travel periods, so you may want to change your route or, if you can, travel outside peak hours. For more information, head to at.govt.nz.
No, no, no! Escape that sentimental sh** this Valentine's at Motat. Karaoke, silent discos, archery, love police, general shenanigans, no cliches, no expensive dinners. Motat Anti-Valentine's, Friday, February 14th, 7 to 11 p.m. Tickets from motat.org.nz.
Whoa, nice antelope you've got there.
I think it's a springbok.
No.
Or is it a dick dick?
Hey!
A gazelle.
Whoa, that's actually Kevin Parker.
Tame Impala is playing Spark Arena. Perfect! If you want to win tickets, then just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week. But you've got to have a B-card. 95BFM presents Tame Impala with support from Kurangbin. Thursday, April 16th at Spark Arena. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
Yesterday was World Wetland Day. Happy World Wetland Day for yesterday, everybody. And well, along with that, we bring you some bad news. Forest and Bird have found that the majority of wetlands on private lands around New Zealand remain unprotected. A series of aerial images from around the country show how freshwater wetlands on private land have completely or partially disappeared from 2001 until 2016. More than 90% of New Zealand's original wetlands have already been destroyed, so what is left is incredibly important. I spoke with Annabeth Conan, a member of Forest and Bird and an advocate for freshwater, about the what to do about the wetlands.
Wetlands are incredibly important. I mean, the first thing is they provide habitat for our birds and our fish. So you can kind of think getting out of the main flow of a river in a place that's rich in nutrients and lots of plants and lots of cover, a little bit different from a lake. A wetland is generally connected to the groundwater, so it's going to be a little bit chemically different. But wetlands are so important for habitat. So all the amazing birds you see around New Zealand, or a lot of the birds anyways, that are traveling from overseas, coming to New Zealand, they look for wetlands to rest in. And our fish go there as well, some of them to spawn, some of them to play, some of them to feed. So they're really important places to our wildlife. They're also quite important for humans too. So you think wetlands, they sponge up, if you will, when there's a big flood, and they release when there's a decrease in water or a drought. So they're kind of like a water storage system, if you will, and they directly connect with the groundwater. Wetlands are also going to be hugely important when we talk about climate change. So they provide that barrier to storm surges and sea level rise. And like I said before, they provide that really important function of cleaning up the water and releasing it when it's needed and sponging it up when there's too much.
Mm. Now, a report was put out by the Ministry for the Environment and Land Care, who surveyed wetlands around the country. Images were released. What do these images show?
The report was put out with the Ministry for the Environment and Land Care research. And what they did is they looked at a particular database and some satellite images and compared the difference. So they didn't have enough money to actually finish the research, but what they did conclude is that the database showed some wetlands had been completely destroyed, something around 250, and some wetlands had been partially destroyed in the sense that they reduced in size, as you could see on the satellite image. What they weren't able to find out is how much area exactly had been lost over the, you know, decade and a half.
Right.
So, but the report concluded that a huge amount of wetlands in New Zealand had been destroyed in just 15 years. And we think that a lot of those may have actually, been drained or dredged, or vegetation had been cleared legally, because the regulations are so lax. There's not good national regulations to protect our wetlands.
Yeah, that kind of leads into my next question, and that was around what are the difficulties surrounding these wetlands that do belong, that are on private land?
Well, if you have a wetland on your property, you might not really understand it, or you might look at it as a fertile opportunity.
Yeah.
So you can imagine agriculture around New Zealand has been encouraged over the last three decades. And so farmers are looking at ways of getting out the swampy, puggy paddocks, drying them out, so putting in some drainage systems, clearing out the vegetation, because that's in the way from, clean, flat grass. And then getting into that fertile land to plant or actually have land animals on it. And if you don't have good regulations to backstop that, then you have regional councils that are granting consents for this type of work. And so then slowly but surely, and this is what we said, it's insidious. It happens over time that these wetlands start to decrease in size and quality until they're gone. And so what we need is we need national regulations that say, this is how we identify a wetland. These are where our wetlands are, and we need to protect them because they provide important habitat and an important function to us as humans, but also to the freshwater environment.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons that these wetlands are drying up may be because of people dredging, you know, and the legalities around the wetlands that is on our private land. What are some of the other reasons that you suspect, or that we suspect that wetlands are drying up and disappearing?
So sometimes these things can happen naturally in the sense that, if there are extreme droughts for a number of years, then that means that groundwater and surface water connection decreases to the point where a wetland might dry up. A wetland could be overtaken with invasive plants, which could sort of destroy the quality, but it would still be a wetland, even though it doesn't have native plants in it. Other things like some invasive fish could really stir up the sediment in a wetland like koi carp, and they could make it really uninhabitable for a native fish.
I see.
So, you know, so one thing is the quality of the wetland. It can still be a wetland and poor quality. And another thing is the wetland actually going? And in order for a wetland to go, you really got to have human intervention, unless there's serious droughts, which, you know, hasn't really happened in New Zealand for long periods of time. So we're talking human intervention is putting in a drainage pipe or a drainage ditch, clearing vegetation, putting in an access road, for example, can destroy the quality of the connection of the water and the plants and all that.
Yeah, it seems to be, like, once again, the underlying factor with any environmental problem is, once again, human intervention. I guess if all the remaining wetland were to dry up in New Zealand, what adverse effects might we see on our climate and the environment?
I don't even want to imagine such a scenario.
Yeah, it's a pretty scary question, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, well, to tell you the truth, we are not... If you compare to the way things were before settlement, you know, we had a huge amount of New Zealand was covered in wetlands. And people will hear the quote, 90% of our wetlands have been, you know, destroyed, lost since human settlement in New Zealand. Now, in the last couple of decades, we've lost even more, something around 13%.
Wow.
And so you can see the percentage of wetlands that we have left in New Zealand is very, very much decreasing year on year.
Yeah.
So the government's looking at changing the regulations, and they're looking at proposals right now for what's called the National Policy Statement on Freshwater Management.
Mm-hmm.
And in there will be provisions that will make precedents or at least bottom lines around the country about protecting wetlands. And while they're not amazing, they are at least the start of what we need to get some national consistency to sort of hold the line on further wetland destruction.
The government has to do their part, of course. What are some other solutions that you'd like to see as an advocate for change?
Well, we've really got to get those regulations passed. So, you know...
I guess that's the first step, isn't it, really?
Yeah, right. So, you know, in terms of that, government's making their decision over the next 3 months. So if you can, write to your MP or your political party of choice and let them know that you really support those wetland provisions, that would be really important. In terms of what individual landowners can do, you know, there are simple things like fencing your wetlands or fencing your stock so your stock can't get into the wetlands. There's all kinds of animals like pigs and cows and deer and sheep.
Yeah.
Less sheep than cows, really. But and other things you can do is just nutrient management, you know, and sediment management, because the way we use our land is putting too much pollution on our wetlands and on our rivers, and it's destroying the quality there. Another really important thing is to consider the vegetation before you cut it. So even if your regional council or district council rules are poor, consider protecting the native vegetation that you've got left on your land, because that could be an indicator of, you know, a wetland habitat there.
What can the average New Zealander do to be a bit more conscious about their wetlands? You know, if this is on private land or public land, how can we get involved and take part in conserving a bit more for our native wetlands?
The most important thing we can do is have conversations, and those conversations need to be about the future that we want to see for New Zealand. And I know that, you know, a prosperous economy is really important, but we can't have that at the expense of a sustained environment.
That's
because
right.
really the environment, our plants and animals and our fresh waterways that are in good working clean order, that's the backbone of our economy, not the other way around. So what we first got to do is restore what we've got and stop the destruction of what we've got left.
Yeah.
That was the Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
That was Lee talking to Annabeth Cohen about wetlands, and now we are going to Iowa, which the Democratic Party in the United States is currently having their first primary race in the state of Iowa to decide the party's candidate for the 2020 presidential race. But before going into the candidates, here's a quick explainer of how parties choose their presidential candidates. But to make things clear and relevant for this year, I will only focus on the Democratic Party. So, to become the nominee of the Democrats, a candidate needs to win enough support from voters from all 50 states and the US's overseas territories, which translates into a majority of delegates at the Democratic National Convention, which this year will be held from July 13th to 16th at Milwaukee in Mississippi. And these delegates are further divided into two, pledged delegates and the unpledged delegates, aka superdelegates. So for pledged delegates, they are elected or chosen at the state or local level with the understanding that they will support a particular candidate at the convention following the results of their state's primary. But superdelegates, who are usually made up by career politicians and party leaders, for example, former or current presidents, representatives at the House of Representatives, senators and governors, and they aren't beholden to the results of the primaries and the caucuses, meaning that they can vote for whoever they want, even those who have dropped out. And in 2020, they only make up 16% of the total delegate vote. But going back up to the pledged delegates, how do party members decide how many of their state's delegates will commit to a certain candidate depends on two ways, by caucusing or a primary. So primaries are very straightforward, in which voters go to a polling place or mail in their ballots or vote remotely. And if a candidate reaches the threshold of getting 15% of the vote, 15% of the votes, because the Democrats use proportional representation, the candidate will get the proportional number of delegates to their vote. And currently, all but four states, which are Iowa, Nevada, Wyoming, and North Dakota, use primaries. And for those four states that I just mentioned, they use caucusing. So, how does caucusing work? And moving into the current Iowa situation, right now, registered Iowan Democrats have turned up to more than 1,000 venues in the state and overseas to caucus. In that venue, a representative for each candidate will be standing in a certain area of that room, and voters have to go and stand in the area where their candidate is represented. So in 2020's case, Joe Biden's supporters will be in one corner, Elizabeth Warren's in another, and Bernie Sanders's supporters in another, and so on and so on. And after 30 minutes, there comes the first alignment and the number of votes are counted. If a particular candidate does not attract 15% of the total voters present, they are not seen as quote-unquote viable and are taken off the ballot, leaving their voters free to throw their weight behind another candidate. So, for example, if Michael Bloomberg does not get 15% of supporters in a library in, let's say, Cedar Rapids, he will be eliminated and his supporters are free to do what they want, including choosing another available candidate, or if he or she decides no candidate is good enough, call it a night and go home. Once the bartering for supporters is over, the votes are added up and state delegates are awarded to each candidate proportionately. That in turn determines how many national convention delegates each candidate receives, and the candidate with the most state delegate equivalents will win Iowa. And now onto the candidates for the Iowa primary. Even though some, such as former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, California Senator Kamala Harris, and New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand have dropped out before the Iowa primary, the race for the Democratic nomination is still a crowded field, including former Vice President Joe Biden.
We can turn 4 years of Donald Trump into an aberration, historical aberration, but 8 years he'll change the country in a way we can't tolerate. We need you, we need you, we need you.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
We win here, we have a path toward victory, and together we will defeat the most dangerous president in modern American history.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Our democracy hangs in the balance. And at this moment, you will decide here in Iowa, what do we do?
And Mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg.
I know there's some ads on TV saying that this is no time to take a risk on anybody new. But I would say at a moment like this, history has taught us we cannot take the risk of meeting a fundamentally new challenge by falling back on the familiar. We can't be afraid.
So, what does the Iowa results mean for the rest of the primary race? Well, on one hand, the result generates momentum for the state's winner, and it could also swing the tone of the race in the favor of the winner's campaign, and it even means the end of someone's campaign. And in history, every winner of a competitive major party presidential nomination contest since 1980, all except one, started off by winning the Iowa caucus, the exception being Bill Clinton in 1992, which he lost to Tom Harkin, who is coincidentally Iowan. Still, take this with a pinch of salt, because Iowa itself, which is rural and demographically more old and white, does not represent the rest of the country demographically, or in retrospect even reflect the current Democratic Party, which is trying to appeal to voters who are more younger, urban, and are of color. But still, make no mistake, winning or losing the Iowa caucus is a big deal, and the results are crucial not only to the Democratic nomination in July, but to the November election, to whether Donald Trump will be re-elected.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Leaving the cold Hawkeye state over the Pacific, we are now back to New Zealand. It's quite sunny out there.
Yes, a beautiful day today, isn't it, Justin?
Yes, it has. So, what have you got for us?
Waitangi Day is approaching very soon. Already today, the government leaders and ministers were welcomed onto the Upper Marae this morning. BFM will be sure to cover all of the affairs over the next few days from this. But just to kick it off now, we cross to Tu Whenuaroa Ngāti Ngāhere. He's an ex-BFMer reporter for the news team, and he's now working for Radio Wātea as a political journalist. I caught up with him for a brief catch-up. Do apologise, some of the audio is a bit dodgy, but it should be salvageable, and I can always translate at the end.
Here's a rundown. So today was the iwi leaders forum, in which most of the iwi from around Aotearoa come and meet annually to discuss a plethora of things.
Yeah.
But today particularly, they were talking about the Oranga Tamariki report that came out.
Mm.
And they put forward some recommendations on what to do about it, and they basically all voted to get rid of it, more or less.
Yeah.
And unanimously. So they vote on things, more or less, and they all voted unanimously to go forward with the recommendations that Whānau Ora had put forward, because they're the ones who were doing the investigation.
Yeah. What's the scene like at the moment today?
What's the scene like here? It's, you know, I'm not sure if you've ever been to it's really interesting. A lot of Māori people around, which is beautiful. I see people running around and tutu and kapaka performances everywhere. Politicians out the wazoo, you must imagine. I saw Simon Bridges was here, Jacinda Ardern, Winston Peters, Meng Foon, Penny Hinare, everybody's here. It really is a place to be over the next week.
Yeah, and as you said, there's been some important discussion that's been taking place. What's kind of the plan over the next couple of days right up until Waitangi Day?
Well, the next couple of days, really, Waitangi Day is more sort of ceremonial, I would say. That's how I would describe the actual day of Waitangi. It's really for sure, you know, crazy stuff happens. the days leading up to it, so the 4th and the 5th, so today and tomorrow, are where the real sort of political sort of juice comes up, right? And so today was not just the final order report, but also some other discussions around Māori issues. One is water rights, you know, especially with everything going on down in Ōtākiri. The dispute over the bottled water and who owns the right to that water.
Yes.
And also te whakaputanga and sovereignty and what that looks like in relation to the government.
I mean, of course, there's a lot of pressure on the government, you know, to address these issues. Would you say there's I mean, there's always tension. Is there tension at the moment, you think?
Well, I mean, like you said, there's always been tension. Out of the meeting that I was just in, a lot of it really was focused towards the state, particularly Oranga Tamariki, and particularly the CEO of Oranga Tamariki, who they are calling to resign, or at least they're calling her to resign. Very harsh, I would say, is the language. Very harsh language being used against her. Which, I mean, if coming from a perspective of particularly whānau water, it's understandable as one.
Why Tangi Day? Why is it important for New Zealanders? How can New Zealanders just be a little bit more conscious around Waitangi?
Well, Waitangi is one of those weird things, because it's always a bit of a media circus, and so you can sort of get wrapped up in the sort of craziness of it all. I mean, if you watch any sort of coverage, there's always coverage of people. Drama between Māori and the government and Māori and government and whatever else. You know, it is the start really of the political year. But if you come to the grounds and you sit with the people and you go around and explore all the stalls and go for a swim, you'll realise that actually it's one of the most beautiful times of the year and one of the most beautiful days of the year, where people just come together from all over the world. Obviously, it's a big tourist attraction as well. I would just say don't buy into the hype. Come and experience it. It's a beautiful place.
That was Tu Whenua Roa talking to me about Waitangi. Sorry, there were some moments where it was hard to hear, but he was speaking about how today there was some proceedings around Oranga Tamariki. I believe it was a unanimous decision to get rid of that. So,
Thanks, Louis, and most of all, thanks to Tu Whenua Roa for bringing that from Waitangi.
That's right.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
So, tradies, finally.
Yes, another tradesperson piece. The trades and vocational training are to receive a boost from the government, placing them at the centre stage for schools. More than 85,000 students will talk to around 4,000 employers at events to promote vocational education in schools. Furthermore, the government is funding more than 300 schools with $3,000 each to run trades-based events and give both students and teachers the opportunity to connect and explore industry-specific careers. Most of these will take place in terms 1 and 2 of this year. As it comes with the government unveiling $13 billion infrastructure program to build and upgrade roads, rails, schools and hospitals, creating thousands of new jobs up and down all over the country. I spoke with Sam Hedgaard, strategic researcher with Air2 Education, about the announcement.
I'm really pleased to see the announcement that Chris Hipkins made a couple of days ago to, I guess, just give, in this instance, high school students some better access to information about potential opportunities in the trades. Because one of the things that we know is that only about maybe 1 in 10, 1 in 15 students will end up going to a university. Actually, the bulk of people will be going to a polytechnic or Wananga or doing an apprenticeship or doing a trades training. And so getting sort of past some of those barriers around what a good future career option could be, it's really critical to make sure that when students are weighing up some of their future options, that if some of the options in trades training is really front and centre in their decision making. So any opportunities to give people the range of, you know, options they can to look at is really positive.
Do you think schools and education institutes could be doing more to push for these pathways?
I think there's been a ton of work that's happened recently to make sure that those pathways are as seamless as possible. But any further moves to support that are really welcome, because it's a really hard period. It's that time when you're finishing up at school and there's kind of the world's the oyster in terms of, am I going to do the OE? Am I going to look for a trade? Am I going to spend some time at a tertiary institution and so on?
Yeah.
And so the more support and the more confidence that high school students can have to make, you know, some, what could be some pretty big life-changing decisions, support to make those decisions is really helpful.
Now, the government, of course, in recent news has announced a $13 billion boost for infrastructure around New Zealand. This is for roads, rails, schools, and DHBs. What opportunities may this provide for the future of the trades?
Well, one of the neat things about having some certainty around future infrastructure needs, as we saw with the government announcement a week or two ago, is that it gives the opportunity for government to really do some smart work around this area that we call government procurement. And so government spends about $41 billion a year on procuring all sorts of different goods and services, from the cleaning and security and property maintenance facilities for government departments and courts and so on, to the road building projects, to a whole bunch of other things. And often that happens in quite a haphazard way, where there's lots of different agencies procuring those goods and services. But the direction of travel from this government has been quite good, and we want to keep going further, about being a bit more coordinated around that. So, for example, if you're going to be investing many billions of dollars in infrastructure, what are some of the ways that we can use that opportunity to not only deliver what the outcome that's needed in terms of the road or the public transport network or so on, but also make sure that the people who are doing those jobs are in good quality jobs and not just minimum wage jobs with minimum conditions and minimum health and safety standards. But, you know, being a little bit more aspirational to say, let's pay the living wage rather than the minimum wage. Let's have really good worker participation around health and safety. Let's have better environmental and ecological stewardship so that we're using as low emissions inputs to, for example, bitumen on the roads as we can, rather than just sort of, often we focus on the narrow purchase price in procurement. But if we can use that to boost what we call social procurement, then that can be really helpful as well. And it delivers more bang for the buck in terms of wider benefits to society.
Yeah, you raise a really good point there about how that, you know, this, although it could be an opportunity, we need to also think about how are the tradespeople going to be themselves? You know, is this going to be a job where they can make a living wage and stuff? So, excellent point there. I guess another one I want to just talk about is education itself is invaluable. And, of course, awareness around this pathway in life starts at the secondary school level. However, there has been some turbulence when it comes to the tertiary level, this announcement of a merger of the Unitechs around the country and the lack of funding. So while awareness and education is important, what can be said about the actual state of the training of the tradespeople?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some massive change needing to have come to trades training for some time.
Yeah.
And actually what government are doing about, we had this sort of problem where there was a lot of different competing parts of the education system, and it wasn't, often it was working well, but it wasn't always delivering the best outcomes for learners.
Mm.
And so what we've seen in terms of having a single national entity delivering polytechnic training, rather than having a whole lot of really precariously funded polytechnics around the country,
yeah,
that's really effective, bringing in some of that on-the-job learning into a more coordinated way, you know, away from what we previously did with industry training organisations. There's going to be some teething problems along the way with that. But the general direction of travel about having better support, better coordination in that area, that just means that the learner pathway is a bit more coordinated and a bit less haphazard. So we're pretty hopeful for the changes that are happening in that sort of design of of vocational education, not only for learners, but also actually, you know, for the staff working in that sector to make sure that those educators and tutors and, you know, tradies who are doing some of that apprenticeship work, that there's some more infrastructure to support them too.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was Louis talking to Sam Haggard, who is the strategic researcher with Ed2 Education, about announcements on vocational training.
That was The Wire.
Koe rā te hotaka mō tēnei wiki. That's all for The Wire today. Thanks to my producer Louis Laws for all his help.
Oh, thank you, Justin, for having me on the show.
Yay, as usual. And special thanks to Joseph Lee, Annabelle Cohen and Sam Haggard, who talked to us today. Massive shout out to Tu Whenua Roa, Nātana Hira, for talking to us all the way down from Waitangi. And of course, our news director, Lillian Hanley, as well. Ka hoki mai, mātou a Terai Wiki. We will be back next Tuesday, both Louis and I. And leaving you in the safe hands of the 124 with Chin. You're tuned into 95 BFM. Have a good weekend. Au revoir.
It's time to kona tere. It's time to kona tere. It's time to kona tere.
Educate.
Along to say, ah, 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 That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.